welcome to a new episode of Nerds Talk Movies. My name is Taylor Cole, and I will be your host today. Joining me is, once again, my co-host, Tristan Benz. Tristan, you were not on the show last week.
I was not.
How are
you
feeling?
Well, I'm feeling fantastic. You know why I wasn't on the show last week? Because I was seeing...
Why were you not on the show?
I was seeing a little film. Well, I was seeing a big film called Dune. And let me tell you...
That indie film?
Little indie film, you know?
From Warner Bros.?
May not have heard of it. It's from a small studio that we've never talked about ever before, called Warner Brothers. We've never mentioned them ever on the show. But let me tell you, good movie. It was based off my favorite book. I mean, it's only the first half of the book, but it was good. Everyone should go see it if they can do so safely.
Hey, it's also on HBO Max.
It is also on HBO Max. But I will say, normally I don't buy into the hype of like, oh, this is something you've got to see in theaters. But, you know, if you can...
Are you going to be that guy right
now? I may be that guy right now because like... There's some big shit in this where you're like, whoa, like this is, it's rare that I feel like straight up transported to another world, but like, this is a spectacle for sure. I will say, you know, Denis Villeneuve seems to have gone to the Chris Nolan school of sound mixing, because there are times where I'm like, I don't know what people are saying, but I only know what's happening because I've read the book. So if you're hard of hearing, definitely watch it at home for the subtitles. But other than that, you know, top tier cinema. Everyone should go see that. But that's not what we're talking about today. No, this isn't a Dune in review.
What is this,
Taylor? This is.
Why don't you lead this off?
This is a Daredevil season one retrospective. This is something we've been billing to for quite a while.
Take number two for us.
Take number two
through issues we just don't really want.
We don't feel like
to,
it.
Be honest, would you?
We're doing our best.
It's okay. It's just a plethora of stuff. We had to postpone it in a week. We still had an episode come out last week, and I thought it was a great episode. But this is one you and I, Tristan, have talked about for months.
When
we were talking about, like, yeah, what are we going to do in Nerd Stop Movies? And both of us were like, well, we love doing these retrospectives and spoiler talks. Let's just do more of those. There was one piece of content that both of us were like, fuck yeah,
we got it.
It
we had to talk
and
about
that
it.
Was Marvel's Daredevil.
We had to do it to him. We didn't have a choice.
And no, it's the TV show, not the movie with Ben Affleck.
Wait, shit, I watched the wrong thing. God damn.
We might eventually get to that.
I hope we do. Come on, I watched it recently.
I think it'd be fun.
Yeah,
I don't think it would be necessarily something that we go, yeah, you know, looking back, it was pretty solid. No,
pound,
I don't think it's going
to
be
pound for pound, 2003's Daredevil can go toe-to-toe with any movie in the MCU.
All right, well, I'm going to have to edit that out,
no,
even
leave
if it
in.
Was sarcastic.
Leave it in. Let people know what I'm about.
So this week, last week, we talked about Sony's Uncharted and some DC fandom trailers. This week, we're pulling the Titans, and we are saying, fuck Batman.
Fuck them.
And we're talking about Marvel content. Specifically, we're going to get into one of the most popular series Marvel has ever put out. And to this day, people still want it back. And there are reports of it coming back. And by God, Tristan, I hope it is.
Oh,
in some way, shape, or form with those actors. And that is Marvel's Daredevil. So long before the days of these Disney Plus shows, long before the days of Loki and The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, WandaVision, Miss Marvel.
Well, we're still long before the days of Miss Marvel if these delay rumors are true.
But long before all these TV shows, Hawkeye even, we had the Marvel Netflix universe. In the early 2010s, Netflix began to create several shows that were vaguely connected to the greater MCU. These shows would focus on a grittier side of the shared universe, and feature some of Marvel's more street-level characters. On April 5th, 2015, Netflix released their first Marvel series, Daredevil.
Oh yeah, they did.
Via IMDb, here's a synopsis for the series. Quote, a blind lawyer by day, vigilante by night, Matt Murdock fights crime in New York as Daredevil. End quote. The Daredevil series was created by Drew Goddard, who originally pitched a Daredevil movie to Marvel, but due to the way the MCU was rolling and at what the proposed Daredevil movie would look like, both financially and tonally, it didn't seem like a great fit. Speaking of good fits, when talking about this subject with IGN, Goddard was asked whether or not Netflix was a better fit for his vision. Goddard had this to say, quote, "It felt like we'd have more freedom to make it on the small screen and make it more adult. Look, if we took the Netflix show and put it in theaters, it's rated R. And they're not doing R-rated movies.
Yet.
And, true. And we also got to really explore the character. I feel like Netflix was the best possible home for that. Otherwise, you'd end up with a watered-down version," end quote. It's also important to note that I think this was either right before or right after the show aired its first season.
Mm.
So, of course, Marvel would... It does seem like they're getting a little dark.
They're getting a little...
and we're gonna get Deadpool eventually.
I was about to say, I mean, they've taken some turns, especially in recent films, you know, and the TV shows.
And Deadpool's
shows.
Gonna be rated R.
Oh, you have to have Deadpool rated R. Like, come on. Come on.
But we're talking about another red hero, or anti-hero, I guess.
Well, Daredevil's a hero. I'd say Daredevil's a hero.
Yeah, I guess less anti-hero. So Daredevil kicked off its first season as an immediate and massive success for Marvel and Netflix. Critics and fans alike praised Vincent D'Onofrio's take on Wilson Fisk and Charlie Cox as the Man Without Fear, a.k.a. Daredevil, two roles that Netflix had to nail down. Many people also loved the darker tone and vicious action sequences, in particular, the notorious hallway fight. Season 1 starred Charlie Cox as Matt Murdock, a.k.a. Daredevil, Vincent D'Onofrio as Wilson Fisk, a.k.a. The Kingpin, Deborah Ann Woll as Karen Page, Eldon Henson as Foggy Nelson, Vondi Curtis Hall as Ben Urich, Toby Leonard Moore as James Wesley, Rosario Dawson as Claire Temple, and more. Now that we've covered some of the background info about this series, and for some reason we had a tangent about Deadpool, Tristan, can you tell us more about Daredevil from the comic side of things? So, who created the character, his best arcs, the arcs we'll see adapted here in season 1, etc. We'll get into the retrospective right after that.
I tell you what, I've got a whole... How many pages do I got? I got two. I got 2 pages worth of notes about comic book Daredevil. And you know why, Taylor? Do you know why? Guess why.
Because they're great?
Because they're great. But also...
I hope you're saying because they're great.
Well, I am great. I mean, we already know this. We know I have a high opinion of myself, but that's not why we're here. We're here because Daredevil's great. And Daredevil is one of my favorite Marvel characters. In fact, in between us failing, you know, our first take of this and then, you know, recording this new take, I've bought a Hot Toys Daredevil figure and it's sitting on my shelf right now. Like, I love Daredevil. He's the man. Anywho, for comics info on the Man Without Steel. Man Without Steel? Man Without Fear. What... I read Stanley and it, you know, had a brain fart. Anyway, let's dive in. So, Daredevil was created by Stanley and Bill Everett in April of 1964. That's where he first appeared in his, you know, Daredevil number one, his self-titled series. Originally, he had a much different tone. He was even called the Sightless Swashbuckler. You know, he was more adventurous. Yeah, that's when he first showed up and he had the yellow suit, you know, with the red accents. His red suit actually didn't appear until issue 7 of that series. It was introduced by comic creator Wally Wood. So, for those first about 2 decades worth of Daredevil stories, he's a very lighthearted, you know, adventure, typical superhero type character. He still has all his powers and whatnot, but it's a more lighthearted affair than we see in this show and in later comics. And
I feel like there's one person.
Oh, there's someone who's directly responsible for that.
Yeah,
there's someone.
I feel like I know where you're going with this.
I'd be shocked if anyone didn't, because that person was Frank Miller of 300 and Dark Knight Returns fame.
If you want to turn a character from, oh, they're pretty lighthearted, to, damn, you okay?
You bring in Frankie.
Frank Miller is your guy.
Frank Miller is the one to I don't want to say ruin your childhood, but give your childhood some childhood trauma. So he revolutionized Matt in the 80s. He turned the Spider-Man villain, the Kingpin, into Daredevil's archenemy. Because up until that point, Kingpin was you know, one of Spider-Man's biggest foes, literally and, you know, metaphorically. Frank also created and introduced Elektra, the Hand, and he made the whole Daredevil mythos have a more street-level martial arts-focused feel. That wasn't, you know, a huge part of the character beforehand. Now, some of Frank's most iconic Daredevil stories include The Man Without Fear, which he did with John Romita Jr. It's a retelling of Daredevil's origin. And Daredevil Born Again, which he did with David Mazzucchelli. He would also do Batman Year One with, which, side note, also read Batman Year One. It's great. But moving on to iconic Daredevil creators, we've also got Brian Michael Bendis, whose run is arguably as iconic as Miller's and has definitely had as much of an impact on the Netflix series. It takes a lot from the tone and just the overall aesthetic and the visual language of the comic. And that run he did with multiple artists, but mainly David Mack and especially Alex Maleev, who, oh man, it's incredible stuff. Actually, I think, and I meant to look this up before we started, but you know how at the end of the season, they hold up the newspaper where it's, oh, officially his name is Daredevil, and they have the artist's rendition on the cover of what Daredevil looks like? I'm like 87% sure that Alex Maleev drew that, like drew the artist's renditions. That's a fun little thing for the fans out there. As for recommended reading, the aforementioned Man Without Fear and Born Again are both solid Daredevil stories for everyone to check out. Bendis and Maleev's whole run, including the out-of-continuity series End of Days, which is about Daredevil's last days and what happens after he's murdered. Daredevil Yellow by Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale is a good standalone origin story for Daredevil. And the current Chip Zdarsky run is just a certified banger right now, and everyone should check it out. We're ramping up to a new event called Devil's Reign. It's good stuff. But that's about all I have for the general comic book info. Anything else that I have, we'll just come across as we discuss the series itself.
Yeah, and for this season in particular, do you have any arcs or comic arcs?
No, this is a pretty general.
Born Again.
Yeah, no, this Born Again.
I know
plays,
Born Again would pretty much be season.
That's
three.
Heavily into season three, but the Daredevil series is unique, and the MCU does this a lot too, where they don't actually directly adapt anything. They just take a bunch of elements from certain things and weave
and
it into its into its own original story. So there's no, to my knowledge, like direct adaptation in this series. Like I've read pretty much everything up from like the late 90s to right now with Daredevil, and to my knowledge there's no one distinct storyline that's all right, we're taking this for season one, because so much of season one is just building up the character of Kingpin and pitting him against Daredevil. So the closest to that would be The Man Without Fear, but even then it's a very different tone. Honestly, The Man Without Fear comic is darker and grittier than season one of Daredevil, if that gives you any context for how like tonally they're two separate entities.
I get you. Well, let's go ahead and get into this retrospective, Tristan.
Let's do it. Let's get in there.
So we have 13 episodes to talk about.
A baker's dozen.
We divided this season with these retrospectives. They're just going to vary in how we do them. They might be divided into sections. We might be able to go episode by episode. It really depends. We divided this season up into four sections. Before we get into each section, we are going to talk about some general thoughts. Let's try to keep it pretty simple here, Tristan, because we're going to be getting into all the deeper stuff later. So what did you think of Daredevil Season 1?
Man, this show's a banger, dude. Like, it has never not been a banger. It will never not be a banger to me. I remember I was so excited for the show when it was first announced, because Daredevil, like, was always my favorite Marvel character. And we've talked about how I didn't get super into Marvel until, you know, the last 2 years over the course of the pandemic. But Daredevil was always the thing. That and the X-Men, where I was like, all right, I got to get involved. So as soon as they announced the show, my hype level's unparalleled. I was so excited that I remember watching the first episode in class instead of paying attention to class. Like, I was like, I can't do this right now, teacher. Like, I need to watch episode one of Daredevil. I've waited too long for this. And just right from then on, like, I immediately fell in love with the show. It's great. Season one's great. The casting is spot on. The visual language of the show is fantastic. The hallway fight is a banger. The music, ugh, unparalleled. I love all of it.
I couldn't agree anymore. I think the best thing this show does, above all else, apart from its cast, which they nailed everybody here. Charlie Cox, to me, is Daredevil.
He is Daredevil. He's the voice I hear when I'm reading Daredevil.
But above all that, I feel like what this show does, like, there's nothing here, I think, that's like, oh, no other show has done this before. Mm-hmm. Like, except for maybe the long cuts and action scenes. But it's all done in new ways.
Yeah.
Like, it's done in ways to where, like, oh, we'll get into a specific episode later where this is from. But there's an episode where one of Gal's men, who all of her drug runners are blind, by the way. Mm-hmm. And he's sitting in the back of a cab, and he's just, like, singing in Mandarin. And it sounds, the way he's singing is just, it sounds unsettling. And the camera pans, and then you see Daredevil right in front of the car. And so he kind of, it's coming across like he's in a slasher movie.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
There's definitely some elements of the camera work in this where it's like, wow, this is not what we see in a typical, like, comic book, you know, superhero property that lend itself to that grittier, more grounded nature. And like you said, you know, that's a perfect example of it, where it feels almost like a slasher film in some aspects. Sometimes when they are showing Daredevil from the perspective of the criminals, it's like, oh, he's almost like a monster to them. Like, this is terrifying. Like, the hallway fight scene, it's almost Jason-esque in the way that, like, he's just walking down there. It's like, oh, we know shit's about to pop off. And then guess what? It pops off. Or then, like, two episodes later when the episode opens up and one of the, like, Russian brothers is running from him, like, and you hear all these gunshots in the building and whatnot, and he tries to get in the car, and then just a thug flies out from the window, you know, two stories up, and lands on the hood of the car. It's like, oh, this is terrifying. Like, Daredevil is here to mess your shit up.
Yeah, and again, it's doing these scenes in ways that we haven't seen before. Not only that, I don't want to make it seem like, oh, so it does nothing new. Like I kind of mentioned, the action scenes, they're longer cuts, and it's just something we don't see enough, and it's annoying.
It's very annoying.
I feel like with movies like John Wick and Daredevil, which felt like one of the pioneers, I guess, behind this, like, okay, let's take the long take and have this great action scene. And Tristan, you and I have disagreed on this in the past, but it's something you would see in, like, Arrow later on, and it would become a staple of that show. And I feel like it's because of a show like Daredevil that you're getting these awesome scenes from, like, John Wick or Arrow and all these other movies and properties. And it's not just Daredevil started it, but they did it so damn well. You can't tell me that hallway fight wasn't like, oh, it's not,
that show
iconic.
Was iconic. And let me side note, I will say, I never disagree that Arrow had good fights. I disagree that it was a good show. The fights were solid. I'll give it that, you know. I watched Arrow for a long time, too. Good fights. Not as good as Daredevil's fights. But what is, you know?
It's kind of hard to be.
It's really hard to be. Like, this thing took to a whole new level.
Top tier, in my opinion. And I think one of the things it does is very well is it doesn't paint Daredevil. Like, we just talked about, there's moments where it feels like he's a slasher in a horror film. But he gets hit. He takes damage.
He gets slashed.
He's not, like, he's not this perfect superhero. He's not even really, like, a full-on hero. It feels like he's just out there beating the crap out of people.
Feels like he's just a dude.
Yeah, and he's also getting beat up at the same time. And we'll get into the early episodes here in a minute. But I love the way they tried to tie together that, oh, he's a boxer at heart. And that's what it kind of comes across as. Like, yeah, he does the flips and all that stuff. He was trained by a blind assassin who is fighting some kind of war going on, which sounds imaginary in season one. We would later find out that there's some more stuff going on. But at the end of the day, he's Jack Murdock's son, and he's somebody who would get hit, keep getting back up, and he's just a boxer at heart. I kind of really like that.
100%, and that's such an important part of Daredevil's character, even in the comics, and they totally nailed it here. 100%.
All right, so let's get into our first section. which is part one, The Man in the Black Mask, and A New Player in Hell's Kitchen. So for this section, we'll be talking about the first four episodes of Daredevil Season 1. These episodes are Episode 1, Into the Ring, written by Drew Goddard and directed by Phil Abraham. Episode 2, Cut Man, written by Drew Goddard and directed by Phil Abraham. Episode 3, Rabbit in the Snowstorm, written by Marco Ramirez and directed by Adam Kane. And Episode 4, In the Blood, written by Joe Pekoski and directed by Ken Garotti. These episodes obviously introduce us to our main characters, Claire Temple and eventually Wilson Fisk. Storyline-wise, this was the batch of episodes that primarily treat Wilson Fisk as like a boogeyman of sorts. Everyone was scared to even say his name in fear of being killed.
That's the
episodes right 1 through 4 has a ton of interesting moments as well, from Jack Murdock's big moment in the ring to the iconic hallway fight with Daredevil to Kingpin decapitating a Russian dude with a car door. So, you know, your typical MCU stuff.
Oh, yeah, we saw that in What If, you know. That's just something we get all the time. Very family-friendly.
It's something you get all the time. Yes, it's so family-friendly. So much blood. So, in all seriousness, Tristan, what'd you think of the first four episodes? How do you think this show performed out of the gate?
Oh, man, right out of the gate, I told you. Like, it started off just with an absolute banger pilot. Just really getting you involved in the world of Hell's Kitchen, and then just the way it ends with the kid getting kidnapped, it immediately launches you into the next episode of like, oh boy, like this is, I gotta keep watching. It gets you hooked, and I couldn't have asked for a better like opening segment of the season. You know, it does a great job of setting up these characters, letting us get hints of, you know, some of their motivations while spending a lot more time with others. It sets up their relationships perfectly, especially love the relationship it establishes between Matt and Foggy. And then you see the hints of, you know, their growing friendship with Karen, where it's like, okay, it's weird that you just, I guess, started working here, but y'all had chemistry. So like, it's fine. I allow it. And then just setting up this presence in Wilson Fisk, where we don't really see him until it's episode 4, right? Where we actually see him full on. Because doesn't episode 3 Rabbit in the Snowstorm? Yeah. So that's the one where we see him in, because he's, you know, so busy staring at the picture and trying to get with Vanessa. But even before he's introduced into the show, like, as a physical presence, it does such a great job of setting up, like, oh, wait a second. Like, who is this person that they're all afraid of? Obviously, you know, if you know Daredevil, then you know who this person is they're all afraid of. But it's just a great tease for the power that this character has without actually having to show him, you know, squishing someone's head in a car door. And then when he does squish someone's head in a car door, you're like, oh, okay, he's a monster. Like, this is terrifying.
Which, by the way, this is kind of a tease for, because we're going to go through the rest of the show as well. This is a kind of tease for my thoughts on season 2. I'm almost done with season 2.
Mm-hmm.
But they do a similar thing with the Punisher.
They do.
To where it feels like the first episode, especially because the Punisher arc in season 2 gets less time than Fisk is the main villain of the entire season. Punisher is more of a recurring character throughout, you know, season 2, and the major antagonist in the beginning of season 2. But for that first episode with Punisher, you do get that feeling of, he is being built up as this like unstoppable army of one.
Mm-hmm.
And Fisk has been like, for 3 episodes, he has built up as this, he who shall not be named.
He's the Voldemort of Hell's
Kitchen. If you name him, you are going to be murdered.
Yeah.
There's a dude in episode 3 that have that guy, that assassin who kills the guy with a bowling ball.
Mm-hmm.
And Daredevil and that guy have an excellent fight.
Oh my god, it's a fantastic fight.
I thought nothing of it going in, because I was like, oh man, I remember this. I remember what happens at the end. It's very brutal.
It's terrifying.
Which I'll get to in a second. But it's such a damn good fight scene. And we talked about the action sequences and the choreography in the general thoughts. Mm-hmm. But it was worth pointing out again here. But this guy, this assassin, was so scared of Fisk that he wanted Daredevil to kill him. When Daredevil said no, he rammed his face into the spikes. They kill himself.
The worst thing I've seen in the MCU. Like every time I cringe.
Which this is, I don't know, like with all the reports, this isn't technically an MCU. I guess.
I mean, it's MCU until proven otherwise.
It's MCU adjacent, which I think is it counts.
I think it counts.
It counts for the time being until we learn.
Exactly. Until they tell us, like, until we see Charlie Cox back as Daredevil and none of this happened, then, you know, it's canon.
It all happened. Just happened. It all happened. A little more family friendly.
Yeah, with less, you know, heads ramming against spikes.
But yeah, man, I really love the Wilson Fisk stuff. Like him being built up, like it felt like we were learning stuff about, like, oh, this guy, he's such a huge threat without ever seeing him. And that's, to me, a tell of, like, good writing.
Yeah.
To where you don't have to force the character into the screen for 3 episodes to get you to give a damn. He wasn't even on screen.
No, he was not. Not until episode 3.
The first few episodes, yeah. Talking about some other stuff in these first few episodes as well, apart from Fisk. I love the first episode, the first scene we get with Matt Murdock. I thought Charlie Cox crushed it in that scene, the confession.
Yeah, could not have had a more perfect introduction to that character specifically, and to Charlie Cox's just tremendous, like, acting ability. It's one of my favorite scenes in the entire series, like, through all 3 seasons.
It's not, like, we just saw a trailer for The Batman, right? Which is Robert Pattinson's version of this character is brutal. He's unhinged. It seems like he just, there's not, something's not clicking yet, you know what I
he's
mean?
Damaged, like, and yes, it's clear, it's damaged. Like, oh, this is a Batman that we see actively needs therapy. Like, it's not like, oh, he's got it contained. And it's like, no, he's,
yeah, he hasn't, yeah, figured it out yet. And I feel like similarly, not exactly, but there's a similarity between that and what we see with Daredevil, to whereas there's a mean streak.
Yeah.
Between,
well, he's got the devil in him.
And Daredevil.
Yeah, he's got the devil.
Yes, which I was going to bring this quote up when he's talking with Father Lantham, and he's in the confessional, and he goes, as my grandmother used to say, be careful of those Murdock boys, they have the devil in them. And the way he delivers that line, it's just so like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, it's like, all right, maybe don't fuck with this guy,
gonna
I guess.
This is going to be a pretty dark series. But also, the other thing, too, all this gets capped off, and we forgot to mention it. And I feel like this is a sin right here for us not to mention this. A movie sin.
It's a sin.
Movie TV sin. We did not mention the theme.
We didn't mention the theme. Well, I mentioned the music earlier, but yeah, we got to talk specifically about this theme, because it's one of the coolest themes in a TV show ever. Like, the visuals of the red, like, candle wax pouring down over the city of New York. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Chills. It's
apart from even the visuals, which are fantastic, you have just,
yeah, the music by John Pisano.
Great up in,
oh god, king shit.
And to me, it's one of probably the best television openings.
I agree.
Like, themes. Of
I
all
agree.
Time.
I never like I to do. Skip the intro when I'm watching Daredevil. I'm like, all right, well, I gotta sit.
Well, I'm also like, I'm writing down the who's writing and directing, so I'm always watching the intro. But at the same time, it's just,
you're
like,
just, you're,
right,
the same time, you're just vibing. You know, you're just like,
yeah,
oh,
it's just
shit.
Like, well, this is nice.
It's like, all right, we got it bumping. A couple other things, just stuff from the comics that especially come up in these first 4 episodes. They introduce us to a lot of characters that we'll see throughout the series who also have ties to the comics that I didn't mention earlier. So in episode 1, the guy who's like trafficking the women who Daredevil just beats the shit out of, Turk Barrett, who we see come up multiple times, is kind of an informant.
Yeah, see, you see him later on, and he's really turned into, like, this joke, like, oh,
yeah,
that's the level criminal Turk.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, well, you hope one day he turns aside. Yeah. Like, this dude just can't catch a break.
He can't.
And you see him in the first episode, and it's like, man, you were, I feel bad for kind of feeling bad about you.
Well, he plays a similar role in the comics where a lot of the vigilantes, and especially Daredevil, just come by and beat the shit out of him. Be like, hey, give me the information I need to know. And, you know, and he'll serve that role throughout the Marvel Netflix series. He shows up in Punisher. He shows up in Luke Cage. I want to say he shows up in Jessica Jones, but I could be making that up.
I think he shows up to Luke Cage knowing, like, oh, Luke Cage is around.
Yeah,
like,
he's like,
that
ah,
one,
shit,
I think, is his own damn fault.
Yeah, like, he knows. he knows. He knows what's up. We also see, we also get Leland Owsley introduced in these early episodes. He's, you know, pretty much the accountant for Fisk's criminal organization. But in the comics, his comic book counterpart is the mutated crime lord called the Owl. He's got like some really, really thick Wolverine style sideburns. You know, he's more animalistic. He's got enhanced strength and he can glide, you know, like an owl. And he just wears like green tuxedos with like a weird little, almost like a poncho, but it's kind of like a really short cape. It's weird. It doesn't work.
If you have seen, I saw this a few weeks ago. If you have seen the 90s Spider-Man animated series.
Of course
series,
I've seen the 90s Spider-Man animated
series.
He is
briefly in that
He's in Spider-Man the animated series? I'd never realized that.
Like, there's a, I forgot what it was. It was something with S.H.I.E.L.D.
Oh, shit.
It was Chameleon. It was the episode with Chameleon. Like,
oh, so like early up. in the show then.
Yeah, like first early five in the episodes show, or something. And it was something with Kingpin talking with the rest of the mob bosses.
Oh, well, shit.
And Owsley is one of them. And I could recognize it immediately. Like, I don't think they say his name, but you can recognize the character.
Oh, if you've seen the Owl.
I know who that is.
If you've seen the Owl, you'll never forget the Owl. But yeah, and in terms of personality, he's very much like the Starscream to Kingpin's Megatron. Like, he's always trying to make a move for himself and, like, you know, become head crime lord. But one other thing is just Claire Temple, who becomes the Marvel Netflix version of Night Nurse. She's a hybridized version of the character from the comics. Essentially, the version that she plays in the comics is called Linda Carter, but the Night Nurse identity is one that is also used by Christine Palmer in the Doctor Strange movie. So there's a fun little connection to the overall MCU there. But that's all the little comic tidbits I have for this first section.
By the way, Bob Gunton
plays Leland Owsley.
He must have been so static that the show was like, all right, so we want you for this role. And you got to imagine somebody probably does research for him. I was like, wait, is this who I'm? No.
I would have been disappointed, honestly. They told me I don't have to wear the little, like, the talons and the thick sideburns. I'd be like, well, then you'll have to find someone else for this role. I demand thick mutton chops.
This is also where we have the iconic hallway fight. Mm-hmm. And just to talk about it a little, I think the second episode is very, very good.
I agree.
Because it's that introduction of Claire Temple, and you immediately, like, the one thing I love about Matt and Claire's relationship is there's a friendship there.
Yeah.
Immediately. But at the same time, like, I love Matt Murdock as a character. One of my favorite characters in all of Marvel. There's nothing, like, completely unlikable about him. Like, he is a likable hero. But he's so fucking stubborn. Sometimes, like, while even as a just an audience member, you're like, dude,
he can be an ass.
And let somebody else.
Yeah.
Like, and the entire time, Claire is just done with it. And I don't know. I just really love that aspect of the character.
She has a very
just the whole time is just like, all right,
yeah.
You know, I'm friends with you, but can we stop here? Like,
she has a low tolerance for his bullshit. Which is necessary when you're dealing with a character like Daredevil, because there's going to be a lot of bullshit coming your way.
But you get that, you kind of get that, the first few episodes don't really show you much of that Daredevil code, which is a big part of the character, and not even in like a Batman sense, where it's like Batman just, oh, I don't want to cross that line, I don't want to become Joe Chill, essentially. This is more, yeah, he has that, but he does have that religious belief, like
it's a moralistic
thing.
Tied to
it as well. It's a moralistic thing, and we will see that in season two as well. He has that mindset of people can be redeemed. He does believe in that. So it's just one of those things that it's not just, oh, I can't cross that line. It's that there's also what I believe in tells me I can't cross that line. Plus, I also think people can come back. It's, you know, layers to it
other than just
I can't kill people.
I'll never be like Joe Chill. It's like, all right, well,
yeah, and there's nothing wrong.
There's nothing wrong with that.
I'm not saying like Batman should be killing.
No, people. Batman should not be killing people. But I will say though, if Batman's going to cross that line, let's just go ahead and scratch the Joker off. Largely because I'm tired of the Joker as a character, but that's a whole other thing.
We can talk about that another time. But I kind of agree with you a little bit because it's so played out.
Besides the point.
This episode also is very well known for the hallway fight. And mother, this is such a good scene. Like, not only because it's a great action scene, but you can tell, like, there's some oomph about it.
Yeah.
Because earlier in the episode, you're told, like, oh, they beat the crap out of Matt, dumped him in the dumpster, left him for dead. So when he comes back, it feels like there's a little more, like, anger behind the punches. I'm not only going to save this kid, I'm going to cause some damage to you because what you did to
yeah,
me.
Yeah, he's got something
like,
to prove.
You done made it personal.
He has something to prove, and he's like, I didn't care for that dumpster. I'm going to beat your ass.
And with this hallway fight, Tristan, do you want to start off with this, like how great it is? Because I will just mention one moment from it.
Go ahead.
Two moments, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
There's one moment in this where he's straight up, like, it just focuses on the hallway, pretty much. And it just pans a little bit to where you see some of the room. There's a moment where it's just focusing on the hallway, and the dude gets knocked into it.
Mm-hmm.
Not into the frame, into the hallway. And then all of a sudden, you just see a microwave come flying at the dude's face. And then towards the end, you actually get a part wherever Daredevil's just like punching the crap out of somebody. And he actually falls into the next room.
I was going to say,
that looks a little cartoonish.
Yeah, that's my favorite
part. It's done so well.
When he falls through the door on the follow through the punch, that is my favorite part of the fight scene. Because it's like, man, he is like, he's a great fighter. He's a top tier hand-to-hand combatant,
but he's tired. And that's something else the show does too. And when I was talking about the action scenes are so fantastic, and really this show is a pioneer to what people love about action scenes today, and I feel like it's because of stuff like that. It's because, yeah, people get tired. That's how this works. For John Wick, people would reload. Like, you see too many times in action movies, like, people just, they fire a gun for like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I was like, well, you never have to reload. Like, you don't have to switch weapons or anything here. Like,
yeah, it's...
And I feel like this was one of those shows that's like, yeah, this, like we talked about in General Thoughts, like Matt Murdock is a person.
Yeah, he's a human being.
Iron Man. Like, we see that through his suit, too, by the way. It's just this very... It looks a little, to me, like... I don't know why it reminds me of this, but like Dexter.
Yeah.
Just that vibe. It's like very minimalistic... Just discreet, that kind of
thing. And it is a reference, it's a visual reference to his look in the Man Without Fear origin series. Before he got his actual costume, he was just running around in just a black mask and, like, sweats.
But what did you think of the fight scene overall? Do you have any moments from it?
I mean, my favorite moment is when he falls through the door on the follow-through. I love when he, like, runs into the room and then shuts the door behind him, and then the next time you see it open is when a dude gets kicked through the door. Like, and that leads up to what you said about the guy.
Isn't that the microwave part?
Well, yeah. Well, because what happens is he kicks a guy through the door, and then someone comes out from the other room to investigate, and that's the guy that gets hit in the head with the microwave. And overall, like, before we move on to part two, I think my favorite fight move, I should say, is when he, like, falls through the door on the follow-through, but I think my favorite moment from the scene overall is the moment he takes his mask off before he enters that door to go comfort the child, because he's like, hey, I realize this will be terrifying if I just roll up on a kid with this black mask after he heard all this violence outside, so let me take a moment and let him know that I'm a human being and that I'm here to help him. I think that's just a perfect Daredevil moment.
This is literally the last thing, because we'll be talking about Fisk and everything later. And that'll be in the next section, especially. This batch of episodes had a lot to do with Matt's origin story of, like, how he was blind. Him kind of showing the, hey, he was a hero, really, when he saved that old man's life and caused himself to go blind. And one of the other things it shows, and I did not remember this when I first watched it, was Jack Murdock is such a great sympathetic character.
Yeah. It's like, oh, he's down on his
luck. He really is. Like, you know, like, hey, he's not, there's nothing like terrible. It's just a good dude who's not the brightest, who's just trying to do the right thing. And he's taking money from the mob just so he can help out his son, help him get to a better life than him. But just, it's kind of that double-edged sword there where it's like, yeah, but I'd love for you to win. You kind of get that feeling.
Yeah.
And that's what Jack decides to do. It's like, I think there's a line here where he was like, just for once, I want Maddie to hear people cheer for his old man.
Yeah.
And that line hits, man.
It really
John
does.
Patrick Hayden, great job as Jack Murdock. You're not, like, he's not playing this, like, pivotal role in, like, oh, throughout three seasons. It's very limited in what he gets to do here. I think he nailed it. And also, just a little bit of great cinematography here. I really like the imagery of Jack walking into the light mm-hmm. on his way to his last fight.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool. And also, we don't get the side of the story from Jack. We don't know of, like, oh, I'm going to beat this guy and bet all the money on myself. We don't know if he had a plan, if he just knew he was going to die. I thought that was very well done.
I mean, it seemed like he knew he was going to die.
He calls his mom.
He calls Matt's mom to be like, hey, like, he's going to need you because I'm about to get fucking killed because I just screwed over the fixer.
But he also, like, tries to escape a little bit. Like, he tries to pack his bags and then he gets caught off guard by people chanting his name out there.
Yeah, and then just we hear the gunshot. Well, Matt, it cuts and we see Matt hear the gunshot, which is a super powerful moment when he runs out there and finds his dad. It's, am I about to go watch, like, season one of Daredevil all over again?
Dude, we will go back to that, too, with where he finds his dad in the alley, because there's something at the end of the show I really want to talk about. But let's move on to the second part. Do you have anything else you want to add here? I don't think we're missing too much, and we'll talk about Fisk so much in the next few sections.
Yeah, no, it's just a great opening set of episodes. That's it, really.
Moving on, let's talk about part two, Wilson Fisk. Here's our next batch of episodes. Episode number 5, World on Fire, written by Luke Caltou and directed by Farron Blackburn. Episode number 6, Condemned, written by both Joe Pekoski and Marco Ramirez, and directed by Guy Ferland. Episode number 7, Stick, written by Douglas Petrie and directed by Brad Turner. And episode number 8, Shadows in the Glass, written by Stephen S. DeKnight and directed by Stephen Sergic. These episodes were absolutely intense. World on Fire and Condemned, they deal with Fisk taking out the Russians and framing Daredevil for it. This is also the portion of the season that seemed to push a few love interest stories forward. Matt and Claire, Foggy and Karen, and Fisk and Vanessa. I know some people listening who haven't seen Daredevil in a while probably are like, wait, what? Yeah, those things happened.
They have.
I know, I didn't believe. I was surprised too.
Well, so were some of the characters involved in those love triangles.
I'm sure we'll have some things to say on all that, by the way. But furthermore, Stick and Shadows in the Glass pushed the present-day stories forward with Fisk stepping out of the shadows and thwarting a plan set in place by Daredevil and Ben Urich, who just started working together too, by the way. However, these episodes are probably far more well-known for their flashback scenes, with Stick introducing Matt's mentor, played by Scott Glenn, and teases another major story outside of the Kingpin arc, which would come to a head in Daredevil Season 2 and somewhat the Defenders. While Shadows in the Glass reveals Fisk's origin story. Tristan, let's start with your quick thoughts on these batch of episodes and work our way to the flashbacks.
Again, like, this, we're still, like, towards the earlier part of the season. We're, like, midway through, and we're still getting a lot of, you know, rising action and introduction to the characters and their motivations. I think the episode with Stick, in particular, of this group of episodes, is my favorite, just because it informs a lot of the way Matt just moves through the world, and it's really interesting to see those flashbacks, and it's got some of the, you know, top-tier fight scenes of this portion of the season. Shadows in the Glass is a great episode, just getting in the head of Kingpin, you know, like seeing everything with his tragic background with his father and just what type of a toxic hellhole environment that he was raised in. And it helps you understand, you know, more of why he's so you know, gung-ho to kind of take the reins of the city, because even though he wants to act like he's not his dad, his dad did, you know, try and, not through the best way, teach him, like, oh, a man has to, you know, take charge and go out there, put yourself out there and be something. And obviously his dad was a piece of shit and like a horrible father and a horrible person, but those lessons stuck with Fisk, whether or not, you know, he's fully conscious of it. And I think just the way it sets up our two, you know, our primary antagonists and our protagonists, it sets up their backgrounds, and you know, they're so clearly diametrically opposed that it's like, wow. So these two,
I think there's also this theme of duality between the two, whereas you see Matt Murdock and Daredevil, like, these, you get Matt Murdock, who's the calm lawyer who, you know, he's, I don't want to say he's a good friend, he's not a good friend.
No, he's not. Like, Matt Murdock's a bad friend.
But you can, there, he's kind of unassuming, and, you know, he is a good lawyer. And then you have Daredevil, this mean, ruthless, brutal vigilante who's just beating the crap out of people.
Yeah.
And you get that with Fisk, too.
You get do.
Wilson Fisk, this sophisticated, calm, like, he's this businessman who knows what he's doing. He has it all figured out. And we see that in episode three, I think, and four. And then when Anatoly, the Russian dude, barges in on his date with Vanessa and embarrasses him.
Yeah.
It harkens back to that, you know, him as a kid. And we start to see that kingpin, you know, the ruthless, you don't know what he's going to do. He just sees red.
Yeah. And it's, like I was saying, it sets them both up in such a way where you immediately know, like, okay, this is what these two are about, and they're so diametrically opposed, and they are on a collision course for one another. Like, and when they come into contact, it's gonna, you know, it's gonna shake Hell's Kitchen to its core. I mean, we get hints of that even when
you see that in episode 5, literally.
Yeah, we see, like, yeah, literally, there's it's shaking
some parts of the city.
And
get
then
blown up.
In the next episode, when they have that first interaction, like via the walkie-talkie, it's like, okay, like, there's like power in this scene, just even over, you know, a walkie-talkie.
And Condemned,
yeah, and Condemned, these two have such great chemistry with each other. It's just it's palpable. Like, you can feel it through the TV screen.
Hilariously enough, like, I love the flashback scenes with both Fisk and with Matt, but, because for Fisk, it's uncomfortable, it's unsettling, it's like, okay, I know where this is going, but it's, the show's trying to do that, so it's doing it so well, and it's also building that, like I mentioned, with Kingpin and Fisk, like, there is that duality between the two, that feels like a different persona a little bit to me.
Yeah.
Like, we don't really see the Kingpin too often in the show. You know what I mean? We see that sophisticated version, but every so often you'll get the flustered brute that is the Kingpin. The one who becomes the selfish, like, screw everything. Because Wilson Fisk, in this season, his motivation is genuinely wants to help
He wants to improve Hell's Kitchen.
In his own delusional way, that's it.
Yeah. But then it's not till we get to the end where we see that
where he's just like,
switch
fuck
flip.
It.
Yeah.
No, so you guys don't deserve it.
And then that's when he becomes the Kingpin.
You get to see that.
Yeah.
And hilariously enough, like, even though I love that, and the Stick episode was great as well, because it shows, like, yeah, Stick's, like, he has some nuggets of wisdom there.
Uh-huh.
That's pretty cool. But there was one line where Fisk, I'm trying to look at my notes right here. That, or not Fisk, one scene where Stick, like, it perfectly encapsulates his character. He's talking to a young Matt about having a gift. Matt says, I never thought of it that way. And Stick just goes, well, that's because you're stupid. So he gives you that, like, nugget of insight that's like, man, that's pretty cool. And he's just, no, he's an asshole.
Like, no, he's
a
dick.
That's about right. But even with those episodes, I think my favorite one out of this batch is World on Fire. And it's crazy because it has some of the stuff I disliked about the season, especially like the Foggy and Karen relationship, because that's when a lot of it came up and I was like, hey, we might be doing this. And my mind back in 2015, when the season aired, was like, oh God, this is about to be a stupid love the triangle thing. I see it coming my way. Thankfully the show doesn't go that route. Same thing with Claire and Matt. I never remembered that they kind of had a thing. But there was a part at the beginning with Claire and Matt where Matt explains to Claire, like, how his powers work. And she says, like, what does that look like? What do you see? And Matt just goes, a world on fire.
It's a dope moment.
And it just cuts to what he actually sees. And you can kind of understand why somebody would be so angry.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah, and it's different than how it's normally portrayed in the comics. Like, in the comics, it's very similar to, or at least it's drawn very similar to the way, have you watched Avatar The Last Airbender?
I saw, I think, the first few episodes, and that was okay.
Well, there's a character in that who's blind, who sees via, like, touch. It's very similar to that. It's
yeah.
When they draw it, it's all, like, silhouettes and shapes. It's typically, like, single color, like, black with, you know, white outlines on things. He can't distinguish features and whatnot, but it's very much a radar sense. Like, that's what they call it in the comics. So, in the comic, traditionally, when you see it from his perspective, it's just silhouettes and then, like, blips on a radar, like, radar waves that are making up the forms that he's, you know, seeing or that he's next to. But it's never, it's typically less detailed than this, I feel like. Because can't you kind of even make out her, like, eyes in this?
I,
like, vaguely
don't remember.
I feel like I vaguely remember seeing, like, the outline of her face, and I'm like, that's even more detailed than we traditionally get in the comics. So I think it's a very mm-hmm. interesting interpretation, for sure.
But yeah, this was also the episode, I believe, yeah, it was, with the action scene I was mentioning in the general thoughts with the guy singing in Mandarin, and you just get that camera cut, and just, you get a pretty cool fight scene out of that, by the way, too. Feel a little bad for the blind dude.
Bad for the blind dude. Just, he was just minding his own business. He gets his head blasted in. It's like, oh, damn.
Like, man, you could move. Like,
well, he's blind. He didn't see the bullet coming. How would he know?
Well, you hear the
you hear the commotion, but he's, you know, he's just minding his own business, singing. He can't tell where it's coming from.
Beforehand.
I mean, I don't know. I feel like, well, didn't he get shot, like, on one of the first couple bullets? Like, it seemed like he was shot.
I feel like you're making a very good point.
Like, I feel like he was shot faster than he could have reacted.
Yeah, I know. I'm starting to realize, like, yeah, you know.
Like, it's night. Yeah,
I think it was early on, so you got a good point.
Yeah. So, I'm saying, not his fault.
The only other note I have, really, I want to mention, and I know this is random. It's going to seem very random. I wrote this weeks ago. I still don't fully know what I meant by this, but I still feel like it's valid.
Well, you got to bring it up now.
And that is, Vanessa comes across as an evil Tess from Ocean's 11. It's a weird comparison.
I get it. I get it, honestly. Like, I mean, Vanessa is Tess if Tess was down for all the fucked up shit Andy Garcia was doing. Like,
I
feel like it's an
apt character in that movie.
You don't remember? Oh, Andy Garcia was...
No, I remember Andy Garcia. I just don't remember the name of his character.
No, I don't remember his name either. I just call him Andy Garcia.
Don't worry. We'll be doing a Ocean's 11 retrospective one of these days.
Oh, man. Ocean's 11. That series slaps. I like Ocean's 8, too. A lot of people didn't. I thought it was a great movie.
But yeah, I think this was just a very well done batch of episodes that, like you said, kind of like, it feels like these episodes were expertly building up to this natural conclusion, right?
Yeah.
Like, it was building up both characters, like, they're on this collision course. You get that talk and condemned between Matt and Fisk. It's where you get Matt's moral dilemma on, like, it's right there in the forefront. Like, even though... the Russian guy, I do not remember his name here. I did have it written down, but I don't... Vladimir.
I was about to guess Vladimir, and just because.
Just because.
Yeah, I was like, just because. That's a Russian name. Honestly, like, I could not have told you 100% certainly that his name was Vladimir, but I was like, what's a Russian name? Vladimir Anatoly. Isn't his brother Anatoly?
Yeah.
See, there you go. Those are the first two Russian names that come to mind.
My thing was, is with him, with Vladimir, who's done so many horrible things, Fisk points that out. And even so, he can't kill him.
Can't kill him.
Daredevil just can't do it. He doesn't have it in him to do it, even though he brings back to life.
Yeah.
In the episode.
He's like, I need information. You're gonna tell me what I need to know about Fisk.
And you get, I don't want to say understanding, but that moment where it's like, yeah, I'll hold him off for you in the sewers.
Yeah. It's an understanding, but it's like one born out of spite, where it's very much Vladimir being like, you know what? I'm going to hold them off. You go ruin Fisk's life, because fuck that guy.
It's one out of spite, not of understanding, like, hey, we've reached more like similar ground here between Daredevil and Vladimir. It's more so of Vladimir finally going, like, okay, I'll swallow my pride here. You will take down Fisk.
It's more of a, we just really hate this same guy, you know? Yes. Where it's like, fuck this dude.
But anything else to add about these episodes?
No, I'm excited to talk about the next batch. That's what I want to get into.
Let's go ahead and let's move on to our third section, which I have to scroll down for, which is part 3, Team Nelson or Team Murdoch. And that is because at the end of the 8th episode, there was one hell of a brutal fight between Nobu and Matt.
But I thought that was the end of the 9th episode.
Is it?
Yeah. Because episode 10 is Nelson v. Murdoch, and that's the whole episode with the
good point, good point. That is on me. That is my bad. It's been a while since I actually saw this document. So part 3, Team Nelson or Team Murdoch. Ignore everything I said before. Getting into our next batch of episodes, we have episode 9, Speak of the Devil, written by Christos Gage and Ruth Fletcher Gage, and directed by Nelson McCormick. Episode 10 was called Nelson vs. Murdoch, written by Luke Keltu and directed by Farron Blackburn. Episode number 11 was The Path of the Righteous, written by Stephen Estenite and Douglas Petrie, and directed by Nick Gomez. And episode 12, The Ones We Leave Behind, written by Douglas Petrie and directed by Euros Lynn. Other than the fight scenes with Nobu and Daredevil, see, I wrote it down right there.
There you go, man.
See, past me, knew what was going on. Like,
he knew what was up.
He's way smarter than me right now. This section of episodes slowed the story down and added a little more drama to the season. Karen and a reluctant Ben learn that Fisk's mom was still alive and that Fisk killed his dad, a revelation that cost Ben his life episodes later. Nelson and Murdoch have a harsh breakup due to Foggy discovering that Matt is the devil of Hell's Kitchen. Vanessa is poisoned in an apparent attempt on Fisk's life, but we later learn that Leland and Gal targeted Vanessa because they believe she weakened Fisk's resolve. Wesley kidnaps and interrogates Karen before she gains the upper hand and kills Wesley with his own gun, leading Karen into a bit of a spiral as she keeps this secret from everyone. By the way, Wesley, what the hell, man?
Yeah, what was his game plan there?
You kind of had some... you had some questionable decisions.
Biggest questionable decision, putting the gun halfway through the table where it was within her reach.
We'll talk about it. But I feel like we should start with the Nobu episode and work our way back from there. But since the Nelson v. Murdoch episode pretty much infected every episode after it, I think we could also talk about that first. It's up to you, Tristan. Which one do you want to talk about first?
I need to talk about this Nobu fight first. I need to take him because let me tell
you. So talk about the Nobu fight and then we'll ask the question. Are you Team Nelson or Team Murdoch?
Let me tell you, boy, the moment that Nobu just drops down from the ceiling in the red outfit, you know the hands are coming. This whole time you're like, oh, I guess Nobu's Yakuza, because they kind of hinted that earlier in the season. It was like, oh, I guess he's, you know,
Yakuza, he sent somebody after him. And then later in the episode,
he takes off the mask. It's like, oh no, it's Nobu himself. Nobu. And you don't even necessarily know for sure, like even before he takes off the mask, that it's Nobu, but you know it's the hand. Because how many red ninjas are running around fighting Daredevil? So it's a dope scene. He finally uses his sticks that Stick gave him. He's throwing hands. Nobu's still just beating the shit out of him, you know, because he's got that superior training. It's awesome. But then, Nobu gets himself set on fire. So it's like, did Matt kind of kill him there? Like, we know he's not dead, but Matt got lucky, but it's like, all right, Matt.
I feel like it was a little self-inflicted.
It was a little, the spilling of the oil was self-inflicted, but then Matt hit the light and it sparked. Instead of my fire.
So that's what I'm saying. I think it's a little self-inflicted. Like, it's still more on Nobu.
It's more on Nobu, but
either way, Matt really likes that.
Let's put it this way. I think in a court of law, that's manslaughter. Like, from my limited knowledge of the law, I think Matt could be held responsible.
Did you say which is Daredevil?
Yeah. It's like, all right, Matthew.
Which is really just this show.
I mean, that and Law and Order. That's about it. I've watched a lot of Law and Order SVU, and from what I understand, Matt's responsible. But no, I think this is a great fight scene, and then it leads into that dope moment with Fisk, where Fisk walks in, and he's like, damn, I was hoping you guys would kill each other, but I guess we'll have to kill you too. And then Daredevil's like, nah, bitch, I'm gonna kill you. And then Kingpin just says, take your shot, because he knows he's gonna dog walk Matt's ass, and boy, does he.
This was probably my favorite fight of the season that was not the hallway fight. Like, I loved in the hallway fight. It's so iconic for every reason. But this was just, Matt got lucky. Like, the show points that out. Like, yeah, Nobu was better.
Nobu was better.
he was better in that scenario.
Unquestionably better. And
I do love when Fisk is pretty much just like, take your shot. And he just knows, like, oh, this guy right here, he couldn't take down one of my men.
He can't do shit.
Right here. So that was great. I loved the fight scene as well. Like you said, Mac does, he kind of skates off because Nobu ends up coming back and not dying. Such a damn good fight scene, and it leads into Nelson v. Murdoch. So what did you think of it, man? What do you make of this whole episode? We talked before about this, and I mentioned like I'm not a huge fan. So try to convince.
I like this episode. I really like this episode. I think, especially with the glut of television programs that we get on the CW, where it seems like everybody finds out everyone's secret identity by the end of the first season, and then we just have seven people knowing all working out of the same base together. Like, I really liked how, for the majority of the season, it was Matt trying to keep his identity secret. And then the moment that someone finds out, it's not just a throwaway line like we get on the CW of like, oh, I guess you're the Flash, okay, I guess we're okay with it now. Like, no, this is, like, this changes fundamentally their relationship. It's not an easy, like, band-aid fix of, oh, you told me the truth, and I guess we're close now. It's Foggy, I feel, has a very reasonable reaction of, what the hell are you doing? Like, even aside from the fact that, you know, you're supposed to have sworn an oath to the law, like, and you're running around just breaking every law in the books aside from murder every night, it's, you have been lying to me this whole time, even before you became Daredevil, of you're not like blind, well, not in the traditional sense, but he's not as helpless as he let Foggy believe. Like, he's kind of been not playing Foggy as a dumbass.
Sins of omission.
Yeah, it's sins of omission, and it's something that I felt Foggy was really justified. That's his best friend. Like, they, in a lot of ways, I feel like over the course of the entire, like, Marvel, Netflix, you know, franchise, I think Foggy and Matt are each other's, like, greatest love interest. Not in a, you know, traditional romantic way, but just in a, like, no, this is, like, they are partners. And I feel that way in the comics, too. Like, yes, Karen Page is a big part of their, like, Matt's journey in the comics. And yes, Elektra is his iconic love interest. But for the most part, through thick and thin, it is Foggy Nelson. Like, that is his,
also
his
a home. Character called Echo.
Yeah,
just
but
gonna drop that in,
yeah,
there, you know.
They date for, like, an arc, and then she goes off and joins the new Avengers, and then they forget about
but
her.
But you know
she
why
becomes
I
a
mentioned
Skrull.
That.
Oh, well, I'm very excited to mention her. I will always talk Echo. I can't wait for the Echo series. Please, God, let that be real. She's got the Phoenix now in the comics. Did you know that? She's the Phoenix. That's crazy. It's a whole thing. She's an Avenger. It's bananas. Anyway, the relationship between Matt and Foggy is just such an integral part of the Daredevil character, and I really liked the way that this episode dissected that. You know, I know a lot of people feel like Foggy was just being whiny, but I think it's, you know, justified when you've spent the last, like, 6 years thinking this person who's essentially your, you know, best friend in the world, you think, okay, you're blind, you know, and you have, well, even if it's not just blind, you have this, you're differently abled in one way, but it turns out you've kind of been, like, playing a con this whole time, and not just a con to the whole world, but a con to me, your best friend, who's told you literally everything about me. Like, I thought it was justified.
I thought, now, if you asked me when I first watched the season, I would have said this was absolutely 1 out of 10, terrible, cannot stand it, because I'm one of those people who are like, all right, Foggy, you're being too much. Like, I understand one of your best friends, your best friend, if this were to happen, that would be a somewhat reasonable response. But throughout the episode, one thing I will point out before I get into a little bit of a rant here, I will always give a plus to hearing drops of Jupiter dropped into anything.
Well, of course.
So, I mean, you got to. But there's a flashback scene where Foggy meets Matt for the first time. And in their first conversation, it's like, we're going to be best friends, no secrets. And I'm like, you're laying it on pretty thick, man.
Like, I was about to say, that's some heavy-handed writing right there. But like,
like, for a show that's been so great, and I'm not just, because we mentioned the writers and directors, so I'm not saying this like too crap on the writers and directors, because also,
yeah, no, they're fantastic.
I don't think this was written very well.
Look, not every line's going to be a 10 out of 10.
It's not, but I feel like a lot of this episode is more so Matt will give an explanation that's valid and it makes sense, and then Foggy would either go, but what about, or I'm just going to ignore that you answered my question. And that's a bit annoying.
All I'm saying is, you find out your best friend, who you thought is blind, is running around at night beating the shit out of criminals.
But he answers every question about it. Like, I understand.
Yeah, but just because he answers the question doesn't mean that he feels like it's a valid answer, yeah, or he feels like that excuses it. You can have an answer to the question and still find it inexcusable. And I think that's more like what people are reacting to. Like, Foggy, he's listening. He's like, okay, you're answering all this, and you're saying, like, okay, well, you had to do this, but you still trained for, like, you know, 15 years. Like, you didn't just one day decide that you'd had enough.
That is the one part where the Foggy I agreed with.
Yeah, he's calling out Matt for being
which
a hypocrite.
Which you also see, and this also leads into season two, and this is where I've sort of came around on it, because I feel like season two, I'm kind of with Foggy a little bit in that season. I can't wait to talk about that whenever we get into that retrospective. As much as Matt does make that case of, yeah, we can't get everybody, we can't help everybody, not everybody, you know, justice isn't served everywhere. And he tells that story of the father abusing his daughter, and he had to do something about it. That is heart-wrenching as hell, and it does prove, like, okay, there's a need for what Matt's doing.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
But then, that is a very good point when Foggy brings up, yeah, sure, but you mentioned you still trained for 15 years. This wasn't a spur of the moment, like, I gotta go out there and retrain. He always knew he'd come back to this, and so, like, there would be that, like, there'd be some kind of thing that would light the match, essentially.
Yeah, and I can't remember, it's because, like you said, we're still in season two right now, like we've been watching. So I can't remember if this line is in this episode or if it's sometime in season two when they're having another argument. But he's like, you act like these things just happen to you. Like, you're choosing to do this.
That's in season two.
Okay. Well, even then, it applies.
I'm going
to
point that back out because I thought that was such a good line in season two. So I've come around with it a little bit because I feel like it's gotten a lot more fleshed out. And plus, I think the later episodes, it's more... This episode makes it seem like it's a clear cut. There's a cut off of the friendship completely, it feels like. And I don't feel like that should have been the case. And then in the later episodes and in season two, you realize, oh, no, it wasn't. It was just like a major fight. And it's kind of weird you brought up that it's kind of like the love interest in a way. Because it does kind of feel like that.
I'm saying they
and again,
longer.
It's
they're
not
best,
in a,
best
it's
boys.
Not in a romantic way. It's just
it's in a bromantic way. One thing, real quick, before we move on, in the comics, Foggy actually finds out that Matt is Daredevil in Daredevil number 347, which came out December 1st, 1995. So for, you know, good 30 years, Foggy did not know Matt was Daredevil. But Daredevil season one, they're like, you know what? Let's just cut through the crap. He needs somebody to talk to, and I respect that.
The other big thing here, we've talked about Nelson and Murdoch falling apart. We've talked about the Avocados at Law for quite a while. We need to also talk about Ben and Karen. Because
yeah, talk about Ben.
And this is where we can kind of talk about both characters here. And to an extent, Wesley. I feel like Deborah Ann Woll is very underappreciated as Karen Page. Because in this season, for most of the time, she gets jack shit to do that's interesting. but she crushes it.
She understands the assignment.
And I'm so glad the character will get so much better in season 2 and 3. But yeah, the early parts of the season, it just feels like she's a bit much. Like, she goes to like a widow's house because in her intro episode, the guy, I can't remember the character's name. Her coworker dies.
Yeah, I couldn't have told you his name. It's generic.
Yes, it's generic.
You know, employee number 7.
And she goes to see the widow. Is like, nothing happened between us and all this. I'm like, that's weird. Why? Why are you bothering people? Like, I understand it's a serious report. Like, she's pretty much playing this reporter role. But it's so awkward the way they're going about it. And we'll see in the finale, like, after Ben dies, she goes up to Ben's widow. And it's like, it was all my fault. I'm so sorry. I'm like,
someone just keep Karen away from the widow. Like, that's all I'm saying.
Can you not wait until after the funeral, Karen? Like, just don't do it as it's going on.
Although I will say that it is a very sweet moment when Ben's widow was like, baby girl, stop making this about yourself. Ben did what he wanted to do. He's Ben.
And like, that saves the scene.
You can't force him to do anything.
That saves the scene for me. Instead of it just being awkward, it ended up being kind of that heartwarming moment.
Yeah, where she's like, Ben Urich never did anything he didn't want.
But I kind of think Karen had a point. Karen got Ben killed, and it's a little disappointing to see twice. That the first time I watched this, I was like, man, Karen kind of gets Ben killed. Second time you watch it, you're like,
you watch it this time, like, oh.
I was right. I was right the first time. She definitely gets him killed, and there was no reason for Ben to die in this season.
Yeah, like and I'm really upset, I will say, like, it's a great season overall, and Vonnie Curtis Hall does an amazing job. And
Vonnie Curtis Hall has this Jim Gordon kind of vibe about him, and it's so cool.
Well, and that's what I was gonna say. Like Ben Urich is such an important part of the Daredevil mythos that, like, he is. I mean, obviously he's not the Jim Gordon because he's not the one sending out there, you know, shining a signal in the sky saying, "Oh, Daredevil, go get the Stilt Man." But like, they do have that rapport, and eventually, like, Ben Urich does learn Matt's identity, and like, he becomes a really close friend, and like, you know, he covers Daredevil a lot for the Daily Bugle. Like, it's a really cool relationship that I wish we got a chance to explore. But yeah, no, Karen definitely got Ben killed. It'd be one thing if, you know, she'd given Ben a heads up ahead of time, and then he's like, yeah, let's go check it out. Then, you know, his wife could say, oh, Ben never did anything he didn't want to do. Ben actively said, I don't want to be here right now, when he found out what it was. He's like, we should leave.
He also said that, like, hey, I'm done. Like, he didn't do it in a way that was like, hey, pushing Karen away from the case or anything.
Yeah, no, he's just like, I want to focus on my wife.
I need to spend time with her, which is such a natural thing to do.
Yeah, it's very valid.
Like I mentioned, Deborah Ann Woll does such a great job in this season. When it comes to the Wesley scene, whenever she kills Wesley, and whenever she just starts drinking, trying to sleep it off, there's just that PTSD.
I mean, that's what happens when you kidnap someone and then you put your gun halfway through the table where they can reach it.
Toby
and it's fully
Lattimore
loaded.
Does a great job as James Wesley. I really wish they could have found some way to keep the character around, because there was some kind of just...
Yeah.
He's unsettling, but he's also so smooth about it.
It's a very calculated unsettlingness.
Not only that, like we talked about Matt not being a good friend. Wesley's a good friend. He's a terrible person, but he is a very good friend.
Oh, awful person, great friend.
If I needed help, I'd call Wesley. I would not call Matt.
We all need a Wesley. I mean, I'd call Matt if I needed someone's ass beat, but that's about it. Everyone needs a Wesley in their life.
All right, you got anything else to add?
No, I mean, well, actually, yes. Is it in, I can't remember if it's in these episodes or earlier, it'll be in these episodes because Matt's still hurt. When he goes to the shop, the workshop where Fisk gets his suits, because he needs to go ahead and setting up him getting his suit. Melvin Potter's shop. I wanted to give a quick shout out to Melvin Potter. In the character, he is the villain called Gladiator, and we get like a tease of that with his body armor that he has underneath. In the little fight scene he has, he's got the saw blade. That's a reference. I can't speak. It's a reference to how his character in the comics like has saw blades attached to his fist that he like tries to kill Daredevil with. And he is, you know, a tailor in the comics who is not all the way there, you know, mentally. So that it's a very faithful adaptation of Gladiator, and I just
but the show doesn't present it in that way. So people who aren't like huge comic fans, they don't expect it.
Like, yeah, it's definitely a thing of like, if you don't know,
you think he's just another Fisk goon. You think he's just like, oh, so Daredevil's about to have a fight scene with this guy, and then just turns out, oh man, he's just being manipulated here. Not even manipulated, he's being blackmailed to help him. So yeah, I really love that part.
He's being blackmailed.
And unfortunately, the character will kind of devolve a little bit into season three, but that's something we'll have to get into then. The only thing I'll say before we move on is I think the reason I didn't care for things like the Nelson v. Murdoch and everybody getting killed from Wesley to Ben is it felt like this show was reaching a natural conclusion at like 9 to 10 episodes. Like we were built, like we said earlier, we're building to this Daredevil Kingpin confrontation. And it was happening without the needs of deaths like Ben and Wesley to add to it. And then we take the break to have a great episode with the Nobu fight and with Foggy figuring out about Daredevil, but it all just felt like it was filler. You know what I mean? It felt like we took a... We are going to our destination, and for some reason we took a right to go see the largest rubber band ball in the country. And I don't know why we went to go do that, because we were almost at the destination.
I don't either.
And so when we come back to the road to get to our destination, it's like we got to ramp things back up. And how are we going to do that? Well, we got to cause some deaths, so we got to get the characters feeling stuff again. So they have to kill somebody off on the hero side. That's going to be Ben. We got to kill somebody off the villain side to piss Fisk off. And that's Wesley.
It definitely at moments feels like it's spinning its wheels, where it's like, all right, like the show overall, 13 episodes.
I think you could probably cut out. That's the sad part.
Yeah, it does. And you could probably cut out content from all 13 episodes and you could get a solid like 11 episodes where it's like, all right, we don't need all this. But definitely in this chunk of the season is when you get that the most of like, okay, like, all right, now we're taking some time. Okay. And nope, we're still going. Yep. Okay. Oh, now Karen's gonna... All right. And Wesley's dead.
I don't think Ben had to die. Wesley, we'll get to it. I don't think he had to die. I think either. Wesley had to because of one bit of dialogue.
Wesley definitely did. But we had enough motivation for
Nelson team, Murdoch, you know, Page.
Nelson,
I don't know
Murdoch
what they call him
when, yeah,
in this
when,
one because. You want to include Karen into it, but they're not technically...
Let's just call it Team Daredevil. We'll just call him Team Daredevil. But we had enough motivation for Team Daredevil when the Elena woman, their client,
and it makes
killed.
That death feel like it was... Well, no one gives a damn that Elena died. That was such a big deal in the early episode, so why should I have cared? Like, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, and they give her a nod at the end when it's like, oh, you know, to Ben, to Elena, but like... we could have just left it to Elena. We didn't need Ben to die. Ben should have come back in later seasons.
Let's move on to part four, Daredevil, which is also the title of this episode. We're at the end of the season. Let's talk about the one and only episode in this section, the season finale. Episode 13, Daredevil, written by Stephen S. DeKnight. And guess who it was directed by?
Who
Stephen
directed
S. DeKnight.
I'm not sure. Oh, a double threat.
So much happened in this season finale, but here are the cliff notes.
Wow.
After Ben's funeral, Matt and Foggy patch things up and decide to kind of be friends again. Fisk figures out that Leland and Gal betrayed him. He kills Leland when it's revealed that his former partner had been holding Detective Hoffman, a corrupt detective, in Fisk's pocket. And if Leland didn't check in every 24 hours, Fisk's life would be ruined due to the shitstorm of scandals that would come his way. In a race to find Hoffman, Matt, Karen, and Foggy figure out where he's being kept, and Matt decides to check it out, saving Hoffman and sending him to Brett Mahoney, who is one of the only cops not on Fisk's payroll, apparently. I can't wait to get into season two, by the way, because there's something Mahoney says.
Oh, man.
And I'm like, dude, did you forget that Fisk owned every cop, supposedly? And some in the early episodes is like, oh, the badge has to mean something. I'm like, it means nothing at all. Did you not see season one? But as he's being arrested, Fisk proposes to Vanessa. We then get a montage of all the corrupt people in Fisk's pocket getting arrested. The whole season was being built up kind of like there's a mole in at the newspaper where Ben worked. And the whole time it's kind of being hinted like, oh, it's Ellison. It's the editor-in-chief there who was friends with Ben. And he started acting like an asshole.
Yeah.
And turns out, nope, it was, I believe, Ellison's secretary.
It was the secretary, so, yeah.
And also, it makes sense why Ellison is not the one. Because he doesn't have the context of anything Ben's saying. Ben's not giving any sources to what he's talking about. You can't print that stuff. Like, nothing that Ben is throwing out there should be printed. And so, Ellison has a point that everything Ben says. It's like, well, I...
Yeah, no, when you go back and look at it, it's like, oh, okay, no, he was just doing his job as editor.
And it's sad, though, because you do kind of see that in season two. If Ellison did take the time to talk with Ben a little more, maybe Ben wouldn't have died. Maybe they were about to get a story together, and you kind of see that character in season two. But we also have Marcy, who was introduced early into season two, and you think, oh, she's going to be an antagonist. She actually ends up helping Team Daredevil take down.
I low-key like Marcy a whole lot. I really enjoy her. I follow the actress on Instagram. She's always like helping retweet the Save the Daredevil stuff. She's fun.
And I feel like that's something else the show does so well. We talked about like doing the same scenes differently in interesting ways. And it's taking stuff like, oh, well, here's going to be an antagonist for the team. Oh, no, they're not. Why did you think that way? That's some close-minded thinking you have there, audience member. This is actually a good
So you're on the wrong side of history, Daredevil audience.
So how do you feel about that? On the way into custody, Fisk has one hell of a monologue about a good Samaritan.
Oh my God, what a monologue.
And it all culminates in his escape. Matt grabs his new suit, and we have our epic final fight. Matt wins. Fisk goes to jail. Vanessa leaves the country. The news gives Matt the name Daredevil, officially. And the season ends on a bright note. So, that's a basic rundown of the finale. Tristan, I really don't know where to start, so I'm just going to throw it to you. Take it away.
Let's start at the end. When we get that moment, and it's one of my, I'll say, top three moments the whole show. After, you know, we've got Fisk's ass in prison, he's staring at the wall, just being a little weirdo, little baby bag bitch, you know. He's like, oh, I'm all sad now because I'm arrested and Vanessa's in Europe. Who cares? Fisk, you're locked up. You're a bad guy. I don't care about you anymore. I care about Daredevil. Because then you get Daredevil standing on top of the roof in his suit, doing the Daredevil thing, just listening. Just listening for crime. Listening for ne'er-do-wells. You know, for scallywags and rapscallions. And he hears a scream, and he's like, oh, it's time to spring into action. What does he do, Taylor? He springs into action. He goes, he runs, he jumps off the building. He's got his billy clubs ready in like a classic Daredevil pose, and it just ends. No, man, I get chills every time. That's such an awesome Daredevil moment in an episode full of awesome Daredevil moments. When he is, you know, throwing he throws the billy club through the windshield and like crashes the car and then lands on top of it to see Fisk, like, you know, crawling out, and he's like, oh my God, who are you? And he's like, oh, you know me, like, I'm the guy who tried to kill you a few episodes earlier and you said take your shot, I'm gonna beat your ass now, you know. What a glow up. Side note, in terms of wardrobe, imagine how confused Fisk must be. Where he's like, I thought this guy was dead. He was running around in a stupid little black hood, and now he's got this drip. It's incredible. It's incredible stuff. I love it.
I highly, highly recommend anybody who wants to go back and watch this show, watch the finale, because it's so damn good for so many reasons. Tristan just talked about everything, and he's completely right about the suit, about the great confrontation with Fisk. And he is not even scratching the surface of how great this finale is.
I know. There's so much.
My favorite part of this finale is Vincent D'Onofrio as Kingpin here. Because when he gets arrested, he has a monologue about this story from the Bible, about the Samaritan. And I can't repeat it, to be honest with you. It would be a waste if I did. because it would honestly be an insult if I did. So I just recommend you look it up. The only thing I will say,
not to Christianity, just to Daredevil,
just to everybody. I feel like it'd just be an offense to anybody. But the end of it's like, it means that I'm not the Samaritan, that I'm not the priest or the Levite. I am the ill intent who set upon the traveler on a road he should not have been traveling on. That's a line that could be just like, well, okay. Vincent D'Onofrio says it in a way to where you're like,
when he says it's like, oh, this is the hardest line I've ever heard. Because it's basically just a fanciful way of saying people need to stay in their lane or I'm going to fuck shit up.
It's basically, he's telling this story basically as a way to go, like, I thought of myself as the person who wanted to make the city better. But when he gets arrested, he sees the city turn on him. And he sees them try to take him away from his love, which is Vanessa.
From Vanessa.
All that stuff, like, we see in the flashback with him as a kid. And you see those moments of him becoming Kingpin, that brute who's just tearing people's heads off of car doors. And it leads to that moment where it's like, you know what? I genuinely wanted to help you people. You know what? Fuck y'all. I'm happy with getting all this money and all this power for myself. Y'all don't deserve it. And that's when you do see the real Kingpin. Like, in full force. He doesn't have the name. Well, he will get that in season 3. But this is where he is basically fully in the flesh.
Yeah. He inhabits the Kingpin mantle fully. And it's terrifying to see.
There's another thing I really loved. We forgot to mention this. But there was a story with Father Lantum in, like, the last...
Oh, yeah.
I want to say it was, like, episode 8 or 9. Where Matt's looking for any loophole in his religion, in his morality. Can I kill Fisk? Is there any way I can do that? Mm-hmm. And Father Lantum brings this great story up, and I don't have it fully pulled up, and I apologize for that. But I think it's just such a good arc for Matt. Like, he's looking for an out. He's looking for any kind of way to kill him.
He's looking for any excuse.
And we get that heroic moment at the end where he goes, like, I don't need to do that. I got this awesome suit, which I don't know why there was any hate towards that suit. I thought it looked good.
It's mainly the mask that I'm not crazy about.
In season 2, so.
Yeah.
But he looks so good, and you get just that heroic moment at the end. And what I love about that fight is it doesn't take place in Times Square. It doesn't take place in front of everybody. It takes place in a dark and damp alley in Hell's
dark
Kitchen.
Dirty alley.
It just so happens not to be the exact place, but a similar place to where Matt's father died. Really damn cool.
Mm-hmm. And it's a damn good fight, just aside from the symbolism, just I feel like straight up in the choreography, because this whole time when we've seen Matt fight people, it's either been, you know, other martial artists, so it's a very, like, almost fluid sort of combat, or it's him taking on, like, gangs of guys. This time, it's just one big motherfucker who, like, sure, Wilson Fisk has some training. Like, he spent some time, you know, doing martial arts, but his main advantage is his size and his strength, and he's just using that to pummel the shit out of Matt. Like, there's not as much technique and fluidity. It's like, it's
he's
a
like
straight
a
up street fight.
It's a bull in a china shop.
He's like a bull.
When he sees red, he can't be stopped, essentially.
It's all over. Like when he does the flying headbutt, he gets a good running start and just goes parallel to the ground 3 feet above the concrete and just headbutts Daredevil right in the chest.
And I found it in my notes here. So a few episodes ago, Lantum was talking about this story about a man named Gahiji and there was a militia. It was such a great scene, though, because, like I mentioned, Matt's just looking for any loophole. And Lantum's also talking about, like, this concept of the devil. Like, Matt was saying, like, do you believe in that? Like, that there's this one figure. And Father Lantum kind of, that's what that story comes from, is he's just trying to explain that he thinks everybody has it in them to be that terrible.
Yeah.
And you do see that throughout the season, essentially. You see that with Fisk, and you see... Honestly, you see it with Matt.
See it sometimes with Matt.
You see it with Matt.
Yeah.
That goes back to the first episode. be careful of those Murdoch boys.
Yeah.
They got the devil in them.
They've got the devil in them. And I can't remember if it's that specific scene or another scene where he's talking to Father Lantum, but it's another scene where he's trying to justify killing Fisk. And Father Lantum's like, another man's evil does not make you good. And that is such a powerful line that really plays into the dichotomy.
We've mentioned a few like of the religious themes too. It's not something I like about the show too, is like, it's not thrown in your face as like, I love Zack Snyder. I do. Zack Snyder laid it on thick, what he was going for with Superman. Sure.
There's some heavy symbolism. We'll be generous. We'll say that. Because Man of Steel is like my favorite movie, but it's a lot.
And Daredevil, like, they use it in a way to where it adds to it. It's just, it's in the background, and when it comes up, it feels like it's thought-provoking in a way. Like, you're just, it's well, a sense of idealism.
I think it's because it's...
I guess.
Yeah, well, it's because it's diegetic, it's organic to the character. Like, it's not just
that
this character is being presented
for no reason.
Yeah. It's not presented in a metaphor. It's not in this visual hint for the audience. It's like, no, this is just an aspect of this character's life. So, of course, it's going to play a role when he's making decisions of this nature. But going back to the line about, you know, one man's evil does not make you good, it plays directly into the relationship between Fisk and Daredevil in every medium, because those two are so inherently entwined and just so opposed to one another on just a fundamental like DNA level, where, yeah, like Kingpin is a monster. Matt Murdock is a hero, you know, but he does some questionable things too, and a lot of times he does them with the excuse of like, oh well, I've got to stop Fisk. Like, he's not going around here killing people, but he's putting people in hospitals for, you know, 6 months at a time. Like, he's crossing some lines, all in the pursuit of taking
Fisk. And what I love about this show, and I just want to add to your point here, Tristan, is it doesn't do it in a way to where it's telling you how to feel. And you see that also in season two.
Yeah, I know.
This is why I get mad at stuff like Titans, where it goes like, oh, Red Hood, he's just a villain who he's killing civilians. When you can have something more interesting, and having these sense of like ideals, and having the audience go, whose side are you on?
Were you caught up on Titans?
We can talk about that off air. But where you can have that talk of like, is Matt even going too far as it is? Is he not going far enough?
Mm-hmm.
And where do you land on it? And you see that in season two, and I cannot wait to have that conversation next week. I don't mean for this to be continually teasing our next episode, but it's something the show does
so well. It's on your mind. You've been watching season two.
But something the show does so well, and then did it in season one too, to where they pretty much they asked the audience like, hey, should Matt kill Kingpin? Like, do you think he should? And it's that sense, that's his journey through the season. That is what he's going through. And that's why I mean, like, he's going to that natural conclusion. And 9 episodes, 10 episodes, you didn't need the foggy interruption. You didn't need the filler with Ben and Karen and Wesley and all that stuff, because I feel like we were getting there naturally. Like, is he gonna kill him? Is he not going to? He's having that hero's journey, and I feel like it was coming to a head, and it does come to a head in the finale, to get back to the finale, and you get that. It feels so triumphant, you know what I mean? It doesn't feel cheesy, and it really could. Like, there's so much stuff in this show that could be cheesy or half-baked.
There's a lot of stuff where that could have not worked out as well as it did with a lesser creative team.
It feels triumphant at the end, and it feels like it's filled with great writing, great character development. Everybody makes sense in the context of what they're presented as.
I agree, 100%. 100%.
All right, do we have anything else to add about that finale?
I mean, other than the fact that it's a banger, like, I think we about covered it.
Anything we missed in total?
Let me see. Do I have any notes? Oh, one, two small notes. We talked about Madame Gal's, drug trade, and we specifically talked about one of her delivery people. But if you actually look at the symbol on her little heroin packets, that's the symbol of the Steel Serpent, which is an Iron Fist villain. So that kind of hints at her, like, connection to Kunlun and all that stuff. actually the Steel Serpent is the character Davos, who we see in Iron Fist season 2, which that connection never gets explained and it's never, you know, explored at all. And then one other thing is when we are in Melvin Potter's workshop, and like I said, I can't remember if this is in this season or in season 2, but I'll mention it in both seasons. Just to,
I think it's in season 2.
Okay, well, keep a lookout, listeners, for season 2. You will see Stiltman stilts in the background of Melvin Potter's workshop. So everyone, keep their eagle eyes out for that.
About Madame Gal, I don't mean to take up a lot of time here. I love how her character is just so unassuming. She just comes across as this sweet old lady, and Fisk.
And then she just fucking.
She has powers. She's.
Just yeah, she has power. She fucking punches Matt in the chest.
The group too, and it's like, well, I did not see that coming.
Yeah, no, it's like no, she's a also gangster.
Also, talking about the acting performances, real quick. Vincent D'Onofrio. So great. We talked about the monologue here, and something I loved about the character is there are times where he's just unsure. Like, the way he sounds is like he just doesn't know. Like, there's just this lack of confidence about him, and you see that through Vanessa, and you know why with Vanessa, but with, like, even Madame Gal, just because he respects Madame Gal. So whenever Madame Gal is saying, like, hey, you need to get your shit together, he takes that very personally. He's like,
oh shit. Like, okay. Madame Gal's calling me.
Like, he doesn't know how to approach it. And you all, then, on the other hand, you see how he acts with people he does not like. There are scenes with Leland here to where he just looks like, if I didn't need this guy for my money, I would just punch him out. He is so annoying. And I really love that performance. Charlie Cox, also fantastic throughout the season. Just that way he could turn on a dime and go from that calm, cool, and collected to just a angry person. So great.
Yeah. It's like you said at the start of the episode, he is to Daredevil what RDJ is to Tony Stark.
All right, let's get into final ratings.
Let's get into those ratings.
Kristen, what would you rate Daredevil season 1 on a scale of 1 to 10? With 1 being a train wreck. And 10 being a masterpiece. Also, please keep in mind that if we ever give something a 6 or a 7 or even a 5, it does not mean we absolutely hated it. 5 is average, 6 is slightly above average, so on and so forth. All this is subjective, so if you agree or disagree, please let us know your thoughts in the comments. And yes, we will be saying this for every retrospective. Kristen, give us your final verdict.
I mean, this shit's a 10 out of 10 for me, fam. Like,
are you?
I love 10? Daredevil. I love this season. Yeah, it's a 10 for me. I'm, you know, and regardless of the. Here's the thing. When I'm rating things, I'm not saying it's a 10 because it's, like, technically perfect and storytelling beats are always.
Every time
be,
you say you know, that, top like, tier. I think of Martin Scorsese and the meme, cinema.
Yeah, I was like, this is. Although I will say Daredevil is cinema. But no, it's a 10 for me just because of how much, like, this show means to me. And this was one of. Like, obviously, I had watched everything in the MCU in theaters, you know, opening weekend to opening night, whatever. But, like, this was the first time there was something in the MCU where I'm like, okay, like, no, like, this is the shit I know. Like, Daredevil is my dude. Like, this is my boy. This is the one I'm hyped to see the most. And it delivered in every arena. So, yes, I give this a 10 out of 10. And I will not be taking any further questions.
Tristan, we talked about this before. And I said I would give it a... I said I was probably going to give it a 7. And you kind of taught me.
You said
you taught me out of
you
it.
You did say that. I did.
And
I did. I talked you up.
I think I'm going to give this a 9. I have some problems with it. I think... The romances early in the season with Karen and Foggy, with Karen and Foggy with Matt and Claire is just, especially in the later seasons, like you forget they ever even happened. So it's like, man, wish you didn't even waste time on that. But I also think it takes a detour in the later part of the season, and it's not as enthralling as the natural progression we were getting with the main story. But it all comes to a head with the one hell of a finale. Like, I don't know what the other seasons entail, but I do put Daredevil, the season one finale, up there with some of the best season finales of superhero shows I've seen.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you'll see when you get to the season finale of season two.
We'll see.
Hint forward to that.
We'll see. But, I mean, acting here, you have Charlie Cox, like we talked about him. He is Daredevil. Vincent D'Onofrio is the Kingpin. They had to nail those roles, and they nailed them. And there's reasons. Daredevil was canceled in 2018. It is 2021. People have not moved on.
I will never move on.
You know why? Because people love these versions of the characters. They want to see him back. And Vonnie Curtis Hall, who this is the only season he appears as Ben Urich, but he does such a great job. I do wish he stuck around somehow. And if we do get an MCU version, maybe Ben's still alive. That'd be great to see. So, fantastic season. This episode will air, I hope. And we will be going on to Daredevil Season 2. Then we'll be taking a short break. We got a pretty cool Clash at the Stash idea we got cooking up here. And then we'll be going into Daredevil Season 3. And then we're going to be going into our, I'm calling them, web retrospectives.
Oh! I like that. You haven't told me that. I'm going to be calling our next batch
of retrospectives web retrospectives, because we're going to be going through all sorts of Spider-Man movies. And I can't wait to get into
those. So many Spider-Mans.
But before we get into those, we have to end this show. We have to talk about what we're working on and where can people find you. So, Tristan, what are you working on and where can the people at home find you? Where is your residence?
I tell you what, people at home, you want to find me, you go to the streets. No. I am still just cranking out, chugging out, churning out. Yeah, I'll tell you what, exactly. Yeah, someone come to my house, I'll have 7 Iron Man armors just waiting. But no, I'm just putting out content over at Screen Rant. You can find me on all the socials at Back Issue Bins. You know, we're making a lot of moves happen with this revamp of the Nerd Stash. So you'll see me start posting some things soon, probably, unless I get really tired. I just started a new full-time job. We'll see how frequently I'm actually posting things, but I'll keep writing. I can promise you that.
All right. I guess as for me, you can find me on this podcast, Nerds Talk Movies. You can find me over at the Nerd Stash Show. Our most recent episode there was a Clash at the Stash. I faced off against Riley. I defended Resident Evil. She defended the Soulsborne series. And it was an intense, intense debate. I cannot spoil who won.
I was about to say I wanted to know who won, but I guess I'll just have to listen to the episode to find out.
But it was a great episode. Michael judged it, Michael Mosley. And he threw a curveball at us because we kind of had a format down of like, okay, so we're going to prepare a statement, we're going to prepare a main case. Kind of had a little bit of a Matt Murdock moment here to where I was preparing for this case. And then after we prepared the cases and we talked about it, then Michael threw some curveballs at us. He started saying, okay, well, tell me why this franchise is better in this category. So we had to talk off the cuff about it, and I thought it was fantastic. I guess we should close up shop. You can find us on Twitter and Discord. Links for both of those are in this episode's description. If you liked what you heard, consider subscribing to our network of podcasts. We have both this podcast and our gaming podcast, The Nerd Stash Show. Sorry, I'm trying to speed through this outro for some reason. If you want to get in touch with us directly, you can do so via DMing our Twitter account, at least for the time being. Thanks to Tristan for joining me this week. Thanks to anyone for listening to us ramble on. Our next retrospective, as I mentioned before, will be on Daredevil Season 2. I can't wait to talk about John Bernthal's Punisher and how that season measures up to the first. A little bit of spoilers. I'm going to have a lot of great things to say, but I can't wait for that. And I guess we'll see you next week.
See you.